But we're talking this morning about Michael Jordan. I was trying to figure out how in the world do you sum up Michael Jordan? Well, some people have called him a ballet dancer with a basketball. Listen to what one sports writer said. He said, his game is a marvelous combination of leaping ability, body control, and split-second creativity. But Michael not only jumps higher than anyone else, he twists his body into such unusual shapes, slips through such minute openings, gauges the trajectory of such impossible shots, and accomplishes it all with such startling speed that he not only succeeds, he confounds. That's a pretty good description. Or you could call Michael Jordan a one-man economic boom. Did you see the story in the Tribune just about a week and a half ago? Front page. Turns out that experts have calculated that Michael Jordan is worth $1 billion to the local economy a year. Increased tourism, economic spin-offs, and things like that. $1 billion! Or you could call Michael Jordan the king of cash flow. Now, last year, Michael Jordan made $35.9 million. And if you break that down, that would be $98,356.16 every day of the week. I mean, if you were to take his annual salary and you were to put it into $1 bills and you were to lay down those $1 bills, they would stretch from this stage all the way to Boise, Idaho and back 3,399 miles. That's assuming there would be a bridge that you could get across at this point. Or you could call Michael Jordan the most successfully marketed athlete in the history of team sports. I mean, his endorsements have boosted the bottom line of everything from Nike shoes to McDonald's hamburgers to Chevrolet trucks to Hanes underwear. As a matter of fact, you know, you wonder, is it worth it? Well, ever since Michael Jordan started gulping Gatorade, Gatorade sales have gone up 20%. Or you could call Michael Jordan the best-known athlete in the world. And you could see that, you know, being from Chicago, if you travel around the world, it used to be years ago, you'd run into someone in Europe or somewhere, and they say, where are you from? You'd say Chicago, and they make pretend they hit a machine gun, they say, Al Capone, right? Now, what do they say? They say, Chicago, Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan, can you get me a poster? Michael Jordan has become a symbol for this whole city. Or you could call Michael Jordan a philanthropist. His Michael Jordan Foundation supports 28 charities that help kids in a variety of ways. In fact, a couple of years ago when the high schools in the city of Chicago, because of budget problems, were going to have to cut sports, Michael Jordan took a Nike shoe and wrote on it a personal check for $100,000 and then took it to Nike and convinced them to double it. Or you could call Michael Jordan the most imitated person in America. I mean, you go to any playground, who are the kids pretending to be? They want to be like Mike. They got the tongue hanging out, they're doing the slam dunks with the, you know, the short baskets and everything. As a matter of fact, I heard a great story about John Paxson, who's one of the other Chicago Bulls. Now, he's not a bad basketball player, right? But when John Paxson goes home, he's got a little son, and sometimes they turn off the lights, and they sort of do the Bulls introduction deal. They turn off the lights, and he takes two flashlights, and he goes, da-da-da-da-da, and now! And his son says, Dad, can I be Michael Jordan? Of course, who else? Well, as I've listed these different descriptions of Michael Jordan, if you were to look for a common denominator and to boil it down into one word, I think the word would be success. I mean, just Michael Jordan's name has come to represent a pinnacle of achievement, a pinnacle of excellence. So much so that career-minded people who are after success, they kind of think of themselves in terms of wanting to be, you know, the Michael Jordan of real estate, or the Michael Jordan of insurance, or Michael Jordan of the classroom. They have aspirations to achieve that kind of excellence and success in their lives. And so as part of this series, I started wondering, you know, what if Jesus and Michael Jordan went one-on-one? Not in basketball, but in conversation. In a conversation, what would Jesus say to Michael Jordan? And I think one thing that Jesus might very well bring up as a topic of conversation would be success. Because there are dangers that Jesus is aware of because he's got the big picture. Dangers that he sees that are lurking along the road to success And Jesus would probably not want to caution just Michael Jordan, but everybody here who might have ambitions to succeed like Michael Jordan has. Now, before we go any further, I think it's very important for me to just pause and to say, you know, I'm doing this message not knowing Michael Jordan. I've never met Michael Jordan. I only know about Michael Jordan what I've read in newspapers and books and seen on television and so forth. And the only time I ever saw Michael Jordan, I was at a Bulls game when they were playing the Bucks up at the stadium. I think it's called the Bradley Center up in Milwaukee. Have you ever been there? This is a huge stadium. And we were like three rows from the top in the nosebleed section, way, way up there. And I can tell you, people say, you know, what's it like to see Michael Jordan in person? I say, you know, it's very amazing. You know, he's only this big. But he jumps so high. But I say that just to say, you know, I don't know the man, and so I only know what I read. I read in the books that he grew up in a very vibrant Christian home, and I hope that he's, you know, maintained that faith. He certainly has a solid background in Christianity, and I'm certainly not going to try, with a lack of personal knowledge, to try to dissect his beliefs or try to critique his personal life in a way that's intrusive. I don't want to do that. So what I want to do is I want to keep the message a little broader by looking at this topic of success and by addressing three points about success that Jesus might very well make to Michael Jordan and to all of us. And these are the points that maybe Jesus would make. First, he might say, guard against the illusion of success. And then second, guard against the trap of success. And then third, guard against the amnesia of success. So let's start first with the comment that Jesus might make to Michael. He might say, Michael, one thing you got to know, as you know, you've been so amazing in your accomplishments, but you need to know, you need to guard against the illusion of success. What is the illusion of success? Well, the illusion of success is when we think we're succeeding in life, but the reality is that we're measuring success by a gauge that isn't telling us the whole story. Let me give you an example. One way that historically society has kept track of who's a success and who isn't a success is by measuring how much money that they've accumulated. And so people strive very hard to build these impressive investment portfolios, and when they do that, they say to themselves, well, I must be successful. The way I feel must be the way that a person feels when he's accomplished success. And now, you know, we're in a church and you may expect me to say, but money can't buy happiness. Or but you can't buy fulfillment and satisfaction with money. I'm not going to say those things because I don't think those things are totally true. I mean, I think the truth of the matter is that money can buy some happiness and money can buy some fulfillment and it can make our life easier to a degree. It can buy us a certain amount of freedom. And all of that is the problem with money. Let me read you a quote author Warren Wiersbe wrote. This is very profound. Listen to this. It says, the problem is not that money doesn't satisfy, but that it does. Do you get that? The problem is not that money doesn't satisfy, but that it does. However, it satisfies only those people who are willing to live on a low level where money brings them their greatest happiness. Isn't that good? In other words, the illusion of success is that you think you're being successful when you're making money, when the reality is that you may be settling for too little. You may be setting your sights too low. You might think, you know, this is what success feels like, when the truth of the matter is that you're just, you know, experiencing, you know, a shadow of what ultimate success really is. In fact, a psychologist did a study of 4,126 executives and professional people who were considered successful by financial standards. She interviewed all of those people over a period of years. And a majority of them, 6 out of 10, said that even though they had struggled and finally made it to where they were financially satisfied, they said they had come to realize that their life was empty and it was meaningless. Empty and meaningless. I mean, they were under the illusion that they were successful because society's measuring gauge told them, you are successful, but they were coming to the realization that real success, ultimate success, must mean something more. And it does. It does. This is what ultimate success is. This is what ultimate success is. God has created each and every person with a gnawing hunger to be connected in community with God. And so it would make sense that ultimate success in life is when you have connected in community with God and you have satisfied the craving that's in your soul. It's like that song we sing sometimes here at New Community. We sing, He satisfies my soul. God satisfies my very soul. You see, that's the gauge for measuring ultimate success. Is your soul satisfied? Is it? I mean, really, I'm asking you the question. Think about it. Do you really have a deep and abiding sense of meaning and of purpose in your life? And ask yourself, do you? Do you feel the acceptance and the love of God and His grace in such a way that you can relax in it and let it set you free? Honestly, do you feel that? Do you feel more and more like you matter to God? Do you feel more and more like the relationship that you have with Jesus Christ? It's growing. It's going deeper. It's more satisfying. It's more real day by day. Ask yourself. I mean, ask yourself, are you living a true adventure of faith? Or are you holding back? I mean, what about your family? Do you feel like your families and the relationships you have with important people in your life, do you feel like they're going deeper, they're becoming more fulfilling over time, growing closer? In other words, is your soul being satisfied? Is it? And I think Jesus would challenge everybody who's on a financial fast track by saying, don't settle for the illusion of success. You're selling yourself short. Don't be content with the kind of fulfillment that your purchasing power buys, because if you do that, you're cheating yourself out of something that's more rewarding. I mean, money's okay. Money has its place. But the problem with money is it's the wrong currency if you're trying to buy satisfaction for your soul, and you were built by God to crave that kind of satisfaction. And Jesus put it this way in Luke 9:25. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit his soul? And he might say to Michael Jordan, you know, Michael, you have, in a very real sense, you have gained the whole world. You've gained the whole world, but never let yourself be taken in by the illusion that that is what success is all about. Keep this test in front of your face all the time. Put it to the test. Is your soul being satisfied? That's a test that all of us can use. A gut check. If we're after, you know, if we're on the right track, we're measuring success by the right gauge. So I think that's what Jesus might talk first about to Michael Jordan and to us. And then second, I think Jesus might say to all of us in general and to Michael Jordan in particular, guard against the trap of success. There is a trap of success. What is it? Well, experts have noticed a trend among people who pursue success with the same kind of single-minded intensity that a high achiever like Michael Jordan does. What often happens is that while these people are pursuing success, at the same time, without even being conscious about it, they are unwittingly building a trap for themselves. And in the end, that trap can spring shut and destroy their life. Well, how do you build a trap like that? What do you mean unconsciously build a trap? Well, let me walk you through a common scenario of how this happens. And as I do this, as I talk about each point, ask yourself, you know, hey, does this apply to me? Is he talking about me? I had a guy come down last night in the bullpen and said, each and every point that you brought up, I said, that's me. And he said, now I'm scared because I feel like the jaws of a trap could slap shut on me at any time. So ask yourself, does this ring true for you? Very often, people with a razor-like focus on their careers begin over time to slowly freeze out their spouse and their kids. You know, much of the time, they're not home at all. They're at the office. The office becomes sort of a surrogate sort of family. Or they're traveling, and when they are at home, they're not really at home, if you know what I mean. Because their minds are preoccupied. They're on the phone with business. And so their relationship with their family begins to deteriorate, and each family member sort of becomes an independent free agent. And that critically important support system is lost over time. It's lost from their life. And then over time, their social circle begins to shrink because they get so wrapped up with clients and colleagues and other people who have a vested interest in their relationship. And so they lose the friends who only cared about them as people, you know, apart from their careers, people who just loved them for who they were. And so that support system after a while is gone. And then they begin to work more and more hours under more and more pressure with less and less time to recuperate. They drop the membership at the health club because who's got time for that? And they really don't have time for the hobbies that used to kind of, you know, be a release for them. And even if they do go fishing or go golfing or go to a ball game, it's to entertain clients or important contacts. And so it's not really an escape. So they never get really recharged or rejuvenated. And so their health begins to be jeopardized. And then they stop taking time for solitude. They stop being introspective about their lives because time is money. And besides, they're getting a little uncomfortable looking inside of themselves. So they don't do that much anymore, and they lose touch with their emotions, and they don't deal with, you know, the shadowy things inside of them that may be driving them in their ambition. They lose touch. Then after they reach a certain level of success, they want to maintain that image at all costs. And so slowly they begin to freeze out the people who used to give them frank and honest feedback, and they replace them with these ambitious assistants who only tell them what they want to hear. Besides, they feel like they know their business better than anybody. What do you really need that kind of input for? And so they lose that honest input. They lose the honest feedback and the accountability, and they become vulnerable to problems that are lurking in their blind spots. Then after a while, they stop stretching themselves in new areas of life because they've been comfortable about the things that they've succeeded in. They want to stick with what's, you know, taken them this far, with what's worked in the past. And so their horizons shrink. And even though they're successful, they start to get bored with what they do. And then God gets displaced from their life because who's got time to pray and who's got time to journal and who's got time to build into a small group? Besides, they start to figure, you know, I got this far all by myself. I think I can go the next leg without God. And so the relationship with God atrophies. Can you see what's happening here? Can you see the trap that they're building for themselves? I mean, they're isolated from loving and supporting relationships. They're out of touch with themselves. They're flying solo without God. They're shut off from honest feedback. They're cut loose from accountability. They're falling into a rut, and they have an inflated opinion of their own ability to handle things. I mean, it's only a matter of time before a trap like that is going to clamp shut and it's going to crush them. Michael Jordan even says, you know, I have nightmares about this kind of self-destructive end to my career. I mean, he literally has had dreams where he's let his success push his life out of control to twist everything out of balance. And he ends up addicted to alcohol, and everything he's worked so hard for in his life gets crushed in a trap that was built by his own success run amok. And he says, when I wake up from a dream like that, I'm numb. I can't even feel anything. See, all of us are vulnerable to that kind of a trap unless we purposefully, we consciously pursue success according to a blueprint, as Bill Donahue said earlier, or maybe since we're talking about Michael Jordan, we pursue success according to a game plan that keeps our lives in balance. And there's a game plan that works. You can look in this book, and you can see a game plan that describes for you how if you keep God at the core, at the center of your life, and how you build around you relationships of families and friends, and how you keep an approach to life that is balanced in the areas of solitude and accountability and rejuvenation. It's a game plan that can take you to success, avoiding the trap along the way. But you got to have something that you can hang on to, something that you, you know, game plan you can look at and read and study. Because if you don't, it's so easy to fall prey in a culture that is chronically out of balance, isn't it? It's nuts out there. Let me read you a quote from well-known management consultant Tom Peters and Nancy Austin. You probably heard of them, the big excellence gurus. This is what they said about success. They said, the cost of excellence is the giving up of family vacations and little league games and birthday dinners and evenings and weekends and lunch hours and gardening and reading and movies and most other pastimes. They said, we have a number of friends whose marriages and whose friendships crumbled under the weight of their devotion to a dream. We are frequently asked, is it possible to have it all? A satisfying personal life and a fully satisfying, hard-working one? And our answer is no, you cannot. You cannot. I mean, you read something like that. Well, what's your reaction? I mean, don't you just want to say the cost of that kind of success is too much? It's higher than I'm willing to pay? Isn't that your reaction? Because that kind of success builds a trap that in the end could very well crush you anyway. And so I think Jesus would tell Michael Jordan, I think he'd tell everybody who's on a hot track towards success, just do this. Stick to the game plan. Stick to the game plan. Stick to the game plan. And always know that I will be there to help coach you through it. But stick to the game plan. And then after cautioning Jordan about the illusion of success and the trap of success, I think third, Jesus would caution him and all of us against the illusion of success. I'm sorry, the amnesia of success. We talked about the illusion, didn't we? The amnesia of success. I guess I have amnesia in terms of where I am. What is the amnesia of success? It's simply this. People who are high achievers sometimes focus so much on what they've done that they forgive to give thanks and to honor the God who enabled them to do it in the first place. That's the amnesia of success. It's like the story about a newspaper reporter. He wants to do a story about the successful people in his community. So he wants to interview the local millionaire who's known as a guy, you know, who's really pulled himself up by his own bootstraps. And so he's interviewing this guy. He says, tell me the story of how you became successful. So the guy says, oh, sure, I'll tell you the story. It's a great story. Says, you know, when I got married, my wife and I were totally broke. You know what we had? All our possessions in the world was one nickel. Just a nickel. That's what we started with. The guy says, wow, that's amazing. What did you do with that one nickel? He said, well, I went out to the store. I went to the Jewel and I saw an apple. But it was a crummy looking apple. They only wanted 5 cents for it. So I bought the apple and I took it home. And I polished that apple all night until it shined. And the next day I went out and I sold that apple for 10 cents. I took that 10 cents and I bought two more crummy looking apples. And I spent that whole, I even got my wife involved. We spent that whole night. We polished that apple up, that other apple, both those apples. The next day we went out, we sell those two apples for 20 cents. And that's the way it went, on and on, until after a period of days, we had managed to save up $1.60. And the reporter says, wow, this is really inspiring. This is like American entrepreneurship. This is wonderful. What did you do when you got the $1.60? What happened next? He said, well, that's when my father-in-law died and left us $20 million. You see, it's human nature to want to talk about the part that we played in our success and to have amnesia about the much greater part that God has played in what's happened in our lives. The Bible says this in the 8th chapter of Deuteronomy. You may say to yourself, my power and the strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me. But remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you the ability to produce wealth.
You know, I thought it was really fascinating when in the last 3 years when the Bulls won the world championship. Do you remember what happened right after the game is over? Cameras go into the locker room and everything. Do you remember what took place? The players huddled and they prayed. And the commentators didn't know how to commentate. And the cameras didn't want to show it. Do you remember that? They cut to a commercial. But I thought, that's great. That here are some guys who are pausing right after achieving the highest accomplishment in their profession. They're pausing to honor the God who gifted them in the first place. I don't know how often that goes on among the Bulls. I was talking last night, the chaplain for the Bulls was here, and he says, you know what? It goes on quite a bit. I said, that's great. So I hope it goes on in all of our lives quite a bit. Because we all know what it's like, you know, when you do something for someone else, you do a favor for them, something nice for them, and you never get a thank you. You never even get acknowledged. You ever had that happen? You feel so disappointed, don't you? So empty. We like to say around here, you know, God has feelings too. I mean, you have the ability to impact the emotions of God by the way that you behave, by the way that you respond to Him. That's an amazing thought in and of itself. And so when we receive from Him without giving thanks, and when we take sole credit for our accomplishments based on abilities that God gave us in the first place, and when we blow off God, we don't come to the communion table to remember Him the way that He's asked us to do it. Can you see how that would disappoint God? After what He's done for us, I think in my own life, I am so quick to get on my knees when I am in trouble and I need help. And I wish I were as quick to get on my knees after God does something great in my life. I have my first reaction be, God, thank you for what you've done. Because that will impact the emotions of the God of the universe. Where He will say, you did the right thing by honoring me. Because I was glad to do for you what I did. But the amnesia of success isn't just forgetting the God who prospers us. It's also forgetting why God has prospered us. Bible says in Luke 12:48, much is required to those to whom much is given, for their responsibility is greater. I mean, there's an expectation that those who have been financially successful will have such a grateful heart over the way that God has blessed them that they will turn around and out of that gratitude, they will serve others and they will help others who are in need. And when they do that, they find out one of the most amazing truths of God, which is that this is one of the most exciting and fulfilling and, you know, satisfying adventures that they've ever been on. It's, you know, I was watching an interview with Michael Jordan the other day on television, and the interviewer is going through the routine questions about the season and three-peats and all that, and he's given the rote answers he's given a million times. But you know what made his face light up? You know what made his voice get all excited? When the guy asked him, well, what's this thing that you're doing with your Michael Jordan Foundation, you know, to help sixth grade kids who are in the inner cities? And that's when he got all excited. Say, you know, we're trying to help 1 million kids all around this country who are in, you know, bad family situations, to kind of help them with their education so they stay in school and on and on. And he got he lit up when he was talking about that stuff. And I think Jesus would say to anybody who's been financially blessed, I think he would say, I want you to experience firsthand how my economy works. Because God's economy works differently from ours. The way His works is that the more that you give to people who are in need, and the more that you sacrifice out of what's been given to you, and the more that you pour out your resources in response to the grace that God has poured into your life, the more you do that, the more satisfaction God will pour into your soul. That's how God's economy works. I mean, it is an adventure, friends, to strategically be involved with making an impact on the lives of people in the name of Jesus Christ. I mean, I'll just give you an example. We had an idea a few months ago. You know, we felt like it would be a great thing if we did a debate here at Willow Creek Church. A a debate of atheism versus Christianity, and let people decide for themselves. We felt like if people heard Christianity tested that way, that people would respond to it. That was a great idea. The problem was, it wasn't part of the church budget. So it was late in the year. We hadn't budgeted for that. So what were we going to do? Well, a businessman stepped up, in effect, and said, you know, God's blessed me with a lot of resources. I would love to turn around and bless other people in the same way. So it's going to cost, you know, like $5,000 for the debate. Here, let me, please, let me underwrite it. And so what happened? What was the impact of that investment? Almost 8,000 people came to this place. Tens of thousands of people listened on radio all across the country. Who knows how many thousands of conversations, spiritual journeys were started. Hundreds of people, if not thousands around the country, took steps toward Jesus Christ. 47 people walked into this place saying, I'm definitely not a believer in Jesus Christ. And they walked out saying, I believe. And their lives were impacted for eternity. How do you think that businessman feels today? What do you think his emotions are, knowing the eternal destinies of people have been rewritten? Because he invested in the business of Jesus Christ. How do you think he feels? You know, it isn't just, you know, the magnitude of something like that that brings that sort of soul satisfaction. God's economy works for those of us who haven't been as richly blessed as that businessman. I was, you know, at dinner just a couple of days ago. We're sitting with the family having dinner together, and the conversation just sort of trailed off. Nobody was saying anything. So I looked at my daughter. She seemed to be kind of, you know, just thinking. And I said, what's going on, honey? She said, I'm just thinking. I'm just reminiscing. I said, what are you thinking about? She said, well, I was just thinking, you know, do you remember last Christmas, Dad, when, you know, we got all the people in our small group from church together, all the kids, high school kids, and we put all of our allowance and the money we'd earned, and we put it in a pot. And we went to the church and we said, you know, could you give us a name of a family that isn't going to have a Christmas this year? You know, a single parent with a couple of kids is just struggling. They gave us the name, and you know, we got to go out and we got to pick out presents for their kids. They weren't going to have any presents. You know, we got to shop and buy them some things, and then we bought all this food and we went over to their house, little apartment, and we threw them a party. He said, Dad, you know, that just meant so much to me. I was just thinking about it. That meant a lot to me. I thought, you know, that's how God's economy works. She'll never be the same. Her soul has been marked. I mean, you think, you know, a teenager in this culture, blessed with so much, to be able to turn around and bless someone who has little, and then to find God in turn blesses her with a memory that will never fade and a sense of soul satisfaction that is the mark of ultimate success. I mean, I think when I was a teenager, I got an allowance, I had a job, I frittered away my money. You know, I never saved a penny, never did anything with it. And a lot of people, frankly, have criticized Michael Jordan. And they said, you know, you admit you like to gamble. You know, you think about all the good things that could have been done with the money that you fritter away gambling. But we don't know Michael Jordan. We don't know what's going on. That's between him and God. And that may be true that those resources could have been used elsewhere, but let's not be so self-righteous. Let's think about in our own lives. Let's think about the way that you and I fritter away resources we have. The way that you and I, you know, sort of let our resources slip through our fingers because we don't steward them or manage them very well. A way that we, you know, buy another sweater or another shirt or another dress and it goes in the closet and we wear it a couple of times. For what? Or we buy a car with all the options instead of just the things we really need. Or we go out and we buy a fistful of lotto tickets. We buy the latest computer gimmick and we use it a couple times and it loses its fun. And the ironic thing is, you know, we fritter away a lot of our resources But we're cheating ourselves. We're the ones who were cheated. We're missing the soul satisfaction that comes when you take those resources, as little or as much as they are, and you invest them in something as spectacular as a debate that rocks a church, or something as simple as helping out a family at Christmas that doesn't have anything. When you think about all the victims of the flood that Bill Donahue just talked about, you've seen the things on TV. Did you see those pictures last night? Al Gore showed a picture, a satellite photo of the Midwest. There were the Great Lakes. There was the flooding. It was bigger than the Great Lakes. This is a tragedy of monumental proportions. And people are suffering. And it isn't just an obligation for us to do something. Friends, it is an opportunity for you to see how God's economy works. For all of us to do that. For some of us to say, you know, this week, instead of going out to lunch every day this week, I'm going to bring my lunch to work and I'm going to save the difference of what I would have spent on going out to lunch, and I'm going to take that and put it in an envelope and send it to the church with a note that says, take this and give it to someone whose life has been shattered by that flood. Give it to them. Don't even send your name. Just make it a private transaction between you and God. Or maybe these teams that Bill's talking about, maybe the resource that you can give is a day out of your weekend to go and to serve these people. Or maybe it's to say, instead of going out to dinner tonight, let's just take that amount of money and let's buy some of the items that are on the list that you can pick up that people need, bottled water or baby food or whatever. Just buy it and give it so we can be a player in God's economy. You see, when we make it an ongoing part of our lifestyle to strategically serve people who are in need, then we fight the amnesia that can cause us to forget who prospered us and why He prospered us. And so I think Jesus would say, you know, Michael Jordan and all the people who want to be like Mike, guard against the illusion of success. Guard against the trap of success. Guard against the amnesia of success. And then he might say to Michael Jordan, then your legacy is going to be secure. Your legacy will be secure. You know, this whole controversy, is Michael Jordan a role model? Are professional sports players role models? Of course they are. Just like you are in your own sphere of relationships. I think God would say, you avoid those, you know, those potholes of success. Your legacy can be secure. And you look at Michael Jordan and you say, he is such, you know, he comes off as such a nice guy. You just want to root for him, don't you? I mean, it's my hope that the legacy that Michael Jordan will leave will not just be that he was the greatest basketball player of all time. And that's a wonderful accomplishment. I'm not downgrading that. That is a great achievement. But I hope that that is not the only legacy that Michael Jordan leaves. I mean, I hope that his legacy will be that here was a man, not a basketball player, a man who wasn't satisfied with the mere illusion of success, but he continued to go deeper, and he is a man who found ultimate success because he connected in community with God and he felt satisfaction at the depths of his soul. And I hope that the legacy of Michael Jordan is that here was a man who kept his eyes on God and who followed the game plan, and who in the end, unlike a lot of other successful people, was not crushed in the jaws of success run amok. I hope that's his legacy too. And I hope his legacy as well is that he is a man who will be known for having honored the God who gifted him. And not only honored that God, but out of gratitude for that gift, he was absolutely lavish in pouring out his resources to people who were in need, and to people who needed to know about the hope that is in Jesus Christ. And what a great legacy that would be for Michael Jordan to leave on this planet. And what a great legacy as well it would be for me to leave that same kind of impression, and for you as well. That is the legacy of true success. Let's stand for closing prayer. Father, we want to thank you, first of all, for the way that you've gifted Michael Jordan, gifted him as a basketball player, because we've all enjoyed watching him compete over the years. you've given us great, you know, thrills in watching that. But more than that, Father, we want to thank you for Michael Jordan, the man. We want to pray for him. We want to pray that you would continue to guide him, give him wisdom, help him grab a hold of your game plan and never let go. And Father, that's my prayer for all of us here. May we all be known as people who achieve success that satisfied our souls. In Jesus' name, amen.